You're listening to The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
Edition of our show, and I'm joined by Dr. Matthew Johnson. So, Dr. Johnson, to kick things off, how are you doing today?
This is your host of the Daily Traditionalist. Well, I appreciate you having me on. I was supposed to be on yesterday, and because of my scheduling conflicts, I slept through it again. This is now the second time I've slept through an appointment with you guys. Really, it's getting, I'm only 45, you know, it's getting bad, so just please forgive me.
Well, you know, you put up with me, so we'll go ahead and forgive you this time. But talking about forgiveness and kind of a segue into morality, the show that I, or the subject I wanted to start on today is Poland, because Poland has really been at the forefront of defending traditional values for a very long time in the post-Soviet period. But it looks like the Polish government has signaled a total U-turn on their total abortion ban. I think, as many folks know, Poland already has a law restricting abortion, except in the cases of rape, incest, the life of the mother, and a few other exceptions. But they're looking to totally outlaw abortion. And there was a huge amount of pressure, huge marches in the streets by women and left-wing groups from all over Europe were coming into Poland. They were getting huge amounts of international pressure from the EU and other people. And just looking at the protests, what I see is the same thing I see every time, whether it's a Black Lives Matter protest, whether it's a Refugees Welcome protest. By golly, they have impeccable signs and chants already made out. This seems to me like another Jewish front. Of course, because the Jews want abortion, the globalists want abortion. They want less white people around to make it easier to replace us. So I want to ask your thoughts on the fact that supposedly a right-wing government, the Law and Justice Party, is the main party in Poland, pulling this U-turn and the protests that we saw in the streets. What does this tell us about what's going on in Poland, on geopolitics, and just kind of your initial thoughts?
Well, you know, the pro-life issue is one of my big ones. It's the reason I got into politics. It's the reason I left music. I left it all. This was the issue. And I couldn't believe that such a thing existed even as a young kid. Then when you have your own children, it's even more frightening. It sounds like this may be the start of a color revolution there. I mean, the last I checked, there wasn't a liberal, you know, in our sense of the word, liberal politician in their legislature. And this seems to be a way. This is a catalyst to overthrow the government.
Well, I mean, with that, you know, how does this work with the abortion ban? Got 450,000 signatures in support of it. Huge support, of course, from the Catholic Church there and most of the people. So why would the government turn its back? Even if there are these international pressures, why would they turn their back on their own people? That obviously the vast majority of them want this, other than, of course, radical leftist loonies that weren't able to even get a single seat in parliament. What does this tell us about the thoughts of the Polish government?
A few things. Don't forget, you know, we all know about China's infamous one-child policy. That was written in New York City. That was written by the Rockefeller Foundation. That was imposed on the Chinese government a long time ago in exchange for investment credits. Now, as soon as they didn't need the West anymore, they repealed all that. And that policy is long gone. This could be something similar. It is so blatantly in Poland's interest, in Russia's interest, Eastern Europe, to increase their population, since it's been plummeting. They've had the worst of all worlds with modernity, the worst aspects of modernity under Marxism, the worst aspects of modernity under this bandit capitalism. They're barely getting their head above water, but they're losing population. You know, it's like they just fought a major war, and the abortion ban just makes sense in general, even despite that. But it's in their interest. And as far as the Jews are concerned, you know, Israel is slowly disappearing in the Middle East because Arabs do not practice birth control. Jews do. They're having Arabs have much larger families than Jews do. suggesting maybe that Israel isn't that important in their minds to begin with, more of a distraction. But it even seems to be in their interest. So this is really demonic in that respect. This doesn't seem to be in anyone's interest immediately in Poland or even amongst Jews. But this has been a Rockefeller a drive for decades and decades and decades.
Well, it's the globalists. I mean, just like when the Soviet Union collapsed, that was in many ways the international Jewish and capitalist elites simply shutting down the branch of an office that had no longer been profitable. And the same thing, I think, could very easily be said for the Zionist experiment. Jewish power really wouldn't be affected at all on the international level if the Zionist state disappeared tomorrow. It's more of, I think, a piece of pride for the Jews, but they're so wormed into Western civilization that there's that divide within the Jewish community between the Zionists and then, of course, I've seen the anti-Zionists that are still Jewish oligarchs, but they don't like that people around the world, especially Arabs, but increasingly in the United States, as we see even leftists on college campuses supporting the divest from Israel strategy and things like that, that when the Jews under their flag are firebombing children, when they're bombing Red Cross aid centers, when they're blowing up elementary schools and things like that, that turns world opinion against them. So I've actually seen a decent amount of Jews and their writings and things like that that say that Israel is bad for the Jews around the world because it basically reveals their face. I kind of want to know your thoughts on that, on the role of Israel, because the international Jewish elites are cosmopolitans. You know, as Adolf Hitler said, you know, one day they're in Brussels, the next day they're in Paris, the next day they're in Berlin, the next day they're in New York City. They don't have a soil. They're like a roving band of locusts. They go from nation to nation to pilfer it. So what do you think on that? Just as a little side note into Middle East politics on the state of Zionism,
they literally don't have,
and whether they want that.
They're not Israelites. You know, they have no connection to the people of the Old Testament. So Israel doesn't mean very much. It just so happens that I'm listening to the last few podcasts of Michael Collins Piper before he died. I'm going to post them myself. And this is one of his last points. He doesn't think that Israel is that important, that Israel has been a drag. It's been a tremendous waste of resources. If there was a legitimate Jewish nationalism looking for an independent, self-sufficient Jewish state somewhere, I don't think a lot of our people would have a problem with that. It's that it's based on completely fraudulent foundations. It's entirely dependent on American money. And it gets Americans hated everywhere on the planet. That's the main problem with it. Hitler was of that opinion. The Jewish state should be. And he was going to transfer them out of the country and with their goods and everything. The very last argument Michael Collins Piper ever made, I think, was that America is the new Jerusalem. New York City is the new Jerusalem. This is the promised land. Not that, point of pride. I mean, that's probably the most you could say about it. They're disappearing. They're losing. And, the press they've gotten with all their control, the left that the Jews created, the Frankfurt School created, is turning against them. They're seen as this militarist, organization in the Middle East with, that's an extension of America. It's the other way around, of course, but that's extremely significant and is very important to the Polish question, or really any national question when it comes to national culture.
Well, exactly. And, the attacks we see on our national culture, of course, are pretty much everywhere. And I wanted to ask your thoughts now, bringing it to the terror front, that the new issue of ISIS's magazine, by golly, I don't know who they're, I do know who their graphics designers are. They're probably sitting in Washington, D.C., but they have a really fancy, good-looking publication. I'll give them credit for that, probably subsidized by the U.S. taxpayer. But their most recent issue just came out, and they're encouraging jihadis in the West not to go and plan big attacks where there's a lot more time to stop you. Going ahead and getting a bomb, getting a rifle, training with that, training to fly an airplane, things like that. They're encouraging these jihadists to use knives and things they have and to target children as they're coming home from school or after school sports, people selling things by the side of the road, people who are walking home from bars and things like that, basically saying that even armed with a knife, you can go ahead and kill a couple people very quickly. And at the same time this comes out, it actually comes together in Brussels today. Two police officers were knifed, and the suspect was shot in a suspected terror attack. One of the officers was stabbed in the neck, and the other one was stabbed in the stomach before the police officer was shot. It was, of course, a male suspect, and it's being called a suspected terror attack. So let's get into this. What do you think of ISIS telling the jihadists that are among us not to focus on these big plots, which, of course, give time for the government to break them up, but to use either informants or, as we know from Edward Snowden, all their collection of metadata to be able to track things down. They're saying basically dumb it down, take it as simple as possible, one-man operation, doing things like this, walking in the streets, stabbing police when you can, going after children, going after women coming home from a restaurant. What do you think on that? What do you think the impact's going to be on our communities?
I don't even know where to begin. I mean, I've read everything in English concerning revolutionary tactics, whether it be jihadism or Marxism or anarchism. And no one advocates that policy. That policy gets you hated. That policy, there's no point. I mean, killing innocent people, that's collateral damage. That's not the purpose. It's unfortunate, but they feel they have to do it. But to target them specifically, it's exactly these kind of wildcat attacks that every revolutionary group that's ever existed up until now has warned against, and they fought against. The Bolsheviks did this prior to the revolution. If it's not authorized by us and it's not something that has a great political impact, then it's not done. Otherwise, you play into the hands of the enemy. This is just one more piece of evidence in this mountain of evidence that we have that is completely phony. It's the U.S. government, the Israeli government, globalist bankers in general. And really the worst of it is they recently killed, I believe they killed a major Hamas commander in Lebanon, closely connected with Iran. So that in and of itself, it shows who they're working for. They won't kill Israelis, but they'll destroy, start destroying the SCO infrastructure in Central Asia and in the Middle East by killing these people. And Hamas, as we know, is doing very well. They're popular. They have a whole infrastructure like Hezbollah does. I don't know what more they have to do to prove to the world that they have nothing to do with Middle Eastern politics. They're an American front to get people hating Arabs and whatever to justify further warfare.
Well, and it's drawing us all in. I mean, the ideology that ISIS promotes says that there has to be a final battle with the West in Syria. And of course, as you mentioned with Hamas, of course, most of Hamas are Sunni. The Shiites who live in Iran and Lebanon and places like that. What unites them all, even though they have differences in religion, is being opposed to Zionism. So I think you make it pretty clear if what unites these organizations that ISIS is fighting, Bashar al-Assad and other governments in the region, is their opposition to Zionism, opposition to Jewish control, Jewish power, that they're only fighting these groups, regardless of Sunni or Shia, and they're trying to advance these this idea of dragging the West into this war, into the Middle East, where they can fight this this final battle in Syria. And that seems to me that the only explanation, of course, is the United States wants to go back. We see the rise of nationalism, especially Arab nationalism. I mean, we've got all sorts of nationalism around the world that's on the march. But the Arab nationalism, after the overthrow of Gaddafi, overthrow of Mubarak, overthrow of Saddam, is reorganizing. They're winning in Syria. So there needs to be a justification to bring the United States back in, bring our coalition of the willing to attack nationalists. Because once we're in Syria, if we go to war there, we're not leaving Syria. You know, it's illegal under international laws we were talking about for us to be there in the first place. So, I mean, do you think basically this is a slow and steady buildup? I mean, they're more than likely will be more explosive, no pun intended, terror attacks to really rile up public support for intervention in Syria and the Middle East in the coming months or year or two. But, I mean, do you see this as just a policy of Israel and the United States, of course, their lackeys, to dupe young Muslims into advancing Zionist interests?
Exactly. I've seen the headlines, and I can't believe they're taken seriously. The sex slave auctions. the deliberately killing children for no reason, beheading toddlers. I mean, this is some of the worst World War II propaganda that no one believes. And it's being, you know, why would any group looking for sympathy and support for their goals tell its people, make this public, by the way? And why would they make it public? That doesn't make any sense. To kill innocent people. Any group that's ever attacked the U.S. legitimately says our problem isn't with the common person, it's with the government and the ruling class. These people are saying, no, we're going to kill the common person. It's none of it makes sense. None of it adds up. And this has been the case with ISIS from the beginning. I had the very first time I heard
just a disaster. Quick side note, even Al-Qaeda, you know, said in their declaration of war against the United States, their purpose for fighting is that, you know, I believe they called them crusaders. American soldiers were in holy sites in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and places like that. Even Al-Qaeda, of all organizations, at least had a legitimate reason, saying the problem was our intervention in the Middle East. It wasn't a declaration of war. Now, that's not to be an apologist for them or anything like that, just talking about the geopolitics. They weren't just flat out saying, let's murder every man, woman, and child.
It's so bad that, they're really its lowest common denominator here. Nothing about it makes sense. What organization is going to deliberately try to be as hated by as many people as possible? That seems to be their goal. It doesn't make sense. This is the worst propaganda, and it's being promoted by the U.S. media as fact.
Well, that just seems to be, you know, the same people who created the World War II propaganda, as you mentioned, are the same people actually putting the propaganda into effect in this case. They don't change their script. They just do the same thing, whether it was claiming Germans were bayoneting Belgian children in World War I or the lies about the Second World War or now today. They're actually just going ahead and doing it because they have the power to be able to get, you know, young Muslims to do this. Now, on the idea of our federal government that, you know, not only is subsidizing a terrorist state overseas and doing all the policies they possibly could to hurt the American people, it's just been revealed that federal agents in California were taking pictures of license plates of people that were attending local gun shows. Now, as we all know, gun shows, probably the safest place you could ever be. You know, if ever there was going to be an attack, definitely I would prefer to be in a gun show than a gun-free zone. But gun shows are 100% legal, where you go and you you purchase firearms. You can buy all sorts of different things for hunting or books, T-shirts, or it's just a great time usually for more conservative, traditional white Americans to celebrate the Second Amendment, celebrate our shared culture, and have a good time while doing it. But it looks like the federal government was engaging in mass surveillance of gun shows. So what do you think on this, Dr. Johnson? Of the government, of course, can't keep track of the guns it sends south of the border with Fast and Furious, of course, that end up killing American citizens and countless Mexicans. Can't keep track of those guns, can't keep track of Afghani soldiers that were here in the United States being trained, several of whom have recently gone AWOL. Can't keep track of billions and billions and billions of dollars to the Pentagon that have just disappeared into nothingness into someone's bank account. Can't keep track of pretty much anything, but by golly, can they keep track of white Americans mostly, who are going to legal gun shows. What are your initial thoughts on this, and what's the reason for doing it?
Well, you know, I've read that before. It gets a big yawn for me. I just assume they've been doing that for years. You know, we're all on, God knows how many lists we're on, how many pictures they have in our files somewhere, but there's a lot of people there. I mean, you're talking about tens of millions of people. It doesn't bother me. In fact, I would take it as, you know, there's so many people being called a hate group or a hater, anti-Semite, racist. Everybody, you know, anyone vaguely in the right wing is called that every day. It's such a huge group of people, it doesn't bother me.
Well, and it's it's a scary thing, but of course, this is what happens when you live in an evil totalitarian regime. And, one of the things to be able to fight this is the need for true nationalism versus fake nationalism. And I want to know your thoughts on something that just came out from France, where Jean-Marie Le Pen, of course, a nationalist who I honor and see as a huge inspiration, has been fighting for his people longer than I've been alive, times two, an absolutely amazing man. And his daughter, of course, took over the party from SNL, kicked him out, and has utterly bankrupted the party, run it into a an absolute, you know, just off a cliff. It's been absolutely horrible. Kicking out the monarchists, kicking out the more fashy elements, kicking out the traditionalist, pretty much everybody, and instead putting kosher-approved, Jew-friendly, homosexuals, all sorts of, it's an absolute mess, and a total embarrassment to French nationalism. Right. And Jean-Marie Le Pen just said that Sarkozy, who, of course, former leader of France, who's a Jew and even pro-EU, has actually become more to the right when it comes to true nationalism than Jean-Marie's daughter, Marine Le Pen. So I want to talk on this as we come to the last third of our show, on the difference between nationalism and kind of this faux nationalism, where it seems that once we start getting success, there's this urge to swing to the left, to moderate. It's, as we've seen in presidential elections, you know, countless times, the Republicans will be, you know, really support the base in the primaries. Once they've locked up the primary nomination, they swing to the middle and end up losing the election because they've betrayed their supporters. They're not going to pick up many undecided or left-wing voters, and it utterly fizzles. This happens time after time after time. And it seems to be happening in France. It seems to be happening in Europe. And there's this urge right now in American white nationalism to do this. We've gotten all this success. We've gotten all this media attention. Let's just quiet down about the Jews. Let's just quiet down a little bit. Let's just ask for a seat at the table. And, you know, it gets pretty bad in a country where guys like Jean-Marie Le Pen have suffered and struggled for decades to build a nationalist movement, only to have it wrecked by driving to the center that's utterly going to please no one and is going to go nowhere. So, first of all, what do you think about France? And second of all, Dr. Johnson, what do you think about this urge that we see in American white nationalism, where some people are saying it's time to moderate? Okay, it's time to really just try and find the center, and we're joking about all of these various things. And, you know, what do you think about that urge to pull to the center that I think is very, very destructive to a movement?
Well, you're aware that the autonomous metropolitan deposed me a few weeks ago on political grounds. Now, these people have known that my radio show is called The Orthodox Nationalist since 2009. These people have read my stuff and have congratulated me for it over the years. All of a sudden, they turn their backs. What changed? Only one thing has changed, that there's a few people associated with me who are actually doing things successfully and growing very fast and, you know, find themselves on the front cover of The Washington Post. That's what changed. The minute you see success, there's panic. I guess they're used to being a subculture, and they wouldn't know what to do with any real power if it were given them. They're kind of happy in you know, kind of in a corner of the library, muttering to themselves. They're happy with that. But as soon as someone does something and things get heavy, the eye of Sauron, as someone said, is on them. They panic. And this may be the case here. I know the National Front was growing greatly. We're winning. And
it's just weakness. I mean, there's nothing to be won. Donald Trump has shown he hasn't pivoted to the center on immigration. He ran on ending free trade and ending immigration, building the wall, and America first. And after he won the primary, I assumed he was going to pivot to the center. I really, truly did. And thus far, I mean, we're not that far out from the election, and he has stayed steadfast. He even went to Mexico, came back from Mexico after meeting with the leader of Mexico, and declared that the wall is still coming, Mexico's going to pay for it, and all the illegals are going home. Mike Pence last night saying that we already have a deportation force. It's called ICE. you know, staying true, and that isn't hemorrhaging his initial supporters, as Republicans have done time and time again. So what would you say to people that, you know, as things are growing, they get skittish. Their hands start shaking, they start sweating a lot, and they basically seem to think we need to act like normal politicians, when normal politics is death, normal politics is stagnation, normal politics is what's good for the enemy. So what would you say to these people that are now saying, as we're growing, as our movement is gaining strength and momentum, that it's time to stop all the winning strategies we've implemented and time to pivot to the center?
Well, you don't really want to know what I would say, you know, in public. I probably couldn't say it over the radio, but what I would say, the cleaned up version of it, would be to get another hobby. this obviously isn't for you. Clearly, you were in this for your own self-identity and to impress people and to have these ideals. But you never intended to do anything with them. You loved the posture. You loved to be a poser. But when actually dirty work came to be done, you backed off. You're the problem. Go collect stamps or something like that and get out of politics. Get out of my field. That's what I would say.
Well, I think that's a really important thing for us to be able to get out there, because these, the soft middle class essentially is what really hits, because when the rubber hits the road and things are getting serious, politics, this is serious. We're at the 11th hour, and if we're not at the 59th minute, we're at 58 and a half right now towards the political, demographic, and economic collapse of the West. It's game time. And like it or not, ladies and gentlemen, if you're planning for your 401k in 30 years and you're afraid of losing your job or things like that, and you're not willing to even donate to the struggle or get involved in some capacity, then you're not taking this seriously. It is a hobby, and you should find a different hobby. Model making, I make models. That's a fun thing. You can do all sorts of things, like you said, Dr. Johnson, stamp collecting. But if we don't win this fight, and we don't win this fight in the next generation, this is the generation that will define Europe's survival or Europe's fall. And it takes all hands on deck to do that. Now, we all don't have to be in the streets like I am or out like you are, Dr. Johnson, but you need to be involved and take this seriously. I mean, what do you think drives, as we're coming to the end here, what do you think drives the hobbyist mentality of so many people that really just don't want to make any sacrifices, even as simple as helping out financially for those who are doing stuff, or even having an anonymous blog or something, just anything to be able to contribute, who think like we do, but they're thinking that someone else is going to do the heavy lifting for them.
Yeah, this has been a preoccupation of mine for a long time. These are often, middle-class people who have a lot to lose. They have a nice position. Their position of, opposition is lucrative. These aren't struggling people. The people who are willing to go out in the streets are those who have very little to lose or nothing to lose. And I think that drives it. I think the middle class mentality is so destructive, that the bourgeois mediocrity that can't picture anything outside of an administrative bureaucratic order. That's very American. That's very, post-war American thinking. And once you're a part of that dead middle class, you can't really think in radical terms anymore. I've been sucked into that vortex. I know what it's like. And when you start losing things, when you start suffering, you realize that suffering isn't really a terrible thing. It strips everything from you so that you can be totally focused on what's real. This is a time of suffering for us, but that pain is not a horrible thing. It drives us. It builds us. It says we can't depend on any. We can't depend on banks or jobs or 401k, like you say. We can't depend on those things. That we have God, we have the nation, we have his creation, and that's all we have. And when you suffer, when things are taken from you, jobs or position, whatever it is, you can see more clearly. And it's not the suffering. This is what, if you're not willing to embrace suffering, then you're finished.
Well, I totally agree. Life is struggle. As I've said before, like a shark has to keep swimming to keep breathing, we have to keep fighting. We have to keep struggling. We have to keep marching forward, even when things get hard. And that's really the definition of being alive. I know so many comrades who are in this with me, who have suffered financially, myself included, suffered socially, suffered physical attacks. But this is the most liberating thing to do, because it's the right thing to do. And you really get to learn who your real friends are, who your real comrades are, and you really take this seriously. It's really very easy to have an opinion in a bar or a posh champagne room, sitting around with other individuals who think like you, but you pretend you don't believe in nationalism, faith, family, and folk when you're out in public. You want to be there's champagne socialists, the champagne nationalists. But what we need is dedicated men and women that are willing to struggle for this, fight for this, unite for this, and win for this. So, Dr. Johnson, as always, love having you on. By golly, it's an interesting world we live in, and I love always getting your thoughts and your opinions on it. Helps clear up a lot of things for myself and our listeners. And to my listeners, it was great being here today with you. Tomorrow, I believe we're going to have Jason Augustus back with us, and got to look forward to another great time finishing out the week. So have a great rest of your day, guys. Have a great day, Dr. Johnson, and hail victory!
be tuned into The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at RadioArian.com.